Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Marbo's most rowdy work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are coming at you live, right here, right now, on the east coast of Australia. In the Discord, though, as well. So if you want to tune in for live recordings, you know where to go.
Yeah, doofmedia.com/Discord.
Exactly right. Let's get into it. We've got two banger chapters this week, starting with 18.6, which opens with Verona enjoying a nice social studies class.
And can we talk about, like, just, I guess, to open up with this, your, like, self-insert character here, Ruben. I guess it's not a self-insert, but...
I didn't insert it myself, but yeah. The alternate reality version of me.
Psychically, you pressure Marbo into putting her in here.
I shift into this universe and role play as Mrs. Morehouse almost every night.
But like the shit she's teaching is so bonkers. Like, is this the sort of stuff they learn in schools in North America or like Canada or something? Because like I didn't learn anything.
Yeah, like this. I feel like it feels kind of maybe analogous to like. Learning more about Indigenous Australian history, which I think they do now in Australian schools. But yeah, it does seem, you know, it's like, it's legit.
Yeah, it was like a level, especially because she was asking them to like compare and contrast different historical things and movements and stuff. And it was like, God, I just had to write down like Eddie Marbo got a win. Like,
yeah, but I think they take it a bit more seriously nowadays, Elliot. Yeah, see, Wabo is saying this is from grade 10 study units. So this is not just kind of pulled out of nowhere.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. I didn't think Wabo was, like, you know, lazy enough to just accidentally drop, like, university-level social studies in here. But, like, I mean, yeah, it must have come a long way then, or it must be very different over there. Because, I was thinking, we did economics in years 9 and 10.
Mm.
And literally the only thing I remember from that class is that you don't have to pay tax, like income tax on lottery winnings.
Mm.
I don't think we learned anything else of substance. It was just nonsense.
It was all gambling related, which I think makes sense for Australian schools.
Yeah. I do know that my school specifically didn't teach the curriculum on social studies, and that was like a whole thing. But
wait, what do you mean? Like, they just refused?
They tied it briefly into geography and history, but we didn't technically do what the curriculum asked of us, I think.
Wow.
But, like, I think even if we had, it wouldn't have been at the level that they seem to be doing it here in Kennett. The civic duty vibes in Kennett found must be leaking through.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. Maybe the school curriculum is being enhanced by Kennett found. And, like, you know, we don't see their gym class recently, but it's really horrifically violent or something as well.
Yeah, Verona did think on how she didn't enjoy it, and maybe that's because, you know, knives were being thrown at them while that
would have made her enjoy it more. That's exactly true, what she wants.
I guess, like, we really do sort of have to talk on, like, the real vibe here is obviously, yeah, Verona really brushing up against this fact that, like, the whole siloing of her life stuff really doesn't work. Like, she's basically sitting in this class processing the fact that the pressures from the other sides of her life are just making school like 100 times worse than it could be. Like, she doesn't enjoy school to begin with, but you know, like, the Jeremy stuff is obviously right in her face, or like some of the awkwardness with Lucy. She even thinks about Tashley. Like, it's just, oh God, she even thinks about Easton not wanting her physically, which is like this hilarious moment where she's like, I know this is fucking stupid, but it's bothering me anyway. And it's just like, just this real vibe of, this isn't like something she enjoys, but it's 100 times harder to stomach it when everything else is going wrong too.
Both of these chapters actually this week are really, well, I guess they start really is better to say. They start really kind of mundanely depressive. You know what I mean? Like, both of them, both Lucy and Verona, feel like they're in really rough places at the moment, but not in any way that, like, anything is going catastrophically wrong. Just kind of like, I don't know, It's just like their day-to-day lives have become depressing for them. You know what I mean?
Yes and no. I we'll talk about Lucy stuff when we get there, I guess. But yeah, definitely with Verona. Like, I guess, I don't know. The sense I had was, it was very much, like, she's never liked school, at least in the context of this story. But the vibe I very much got was, like, what she was realizing is it was even harder because other stuff is stressing her out. Like, Verona is finally starting to realize that, you know, the pressure of other things is really impacting the other parts of her life. Like, things not going well with Jeremy has this flow-on effect into the other things, and she can't just compartmentalize everything like this. Like, it's just not realistic.
Yeah.
And obviously, we'll get to the whole concept of homeschooling or distance education for Verona that, you know, finally comes up later in this chapter. But, like, it's not an accident that the chapter that finally discusses that as a possibility opens with, you know, what is the feeling most painful. So horrible.
Yeah. The toothpick under the toe kicking thing is, like, really viscerally uncomfortable, you know? Like, you feel it every time she thinks kick, kick, kick.
Yeah, I under fingernail stuff still gets to me ever since that scene in season one of Lost where the guy tortures the other guy by sticking bamboo under his fingernail. That shit scarred me as a kid. Yeah, Saeed, that's the scene. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess because like really the thing you see with the school stuff here is like this is pushing Verona further away, and we'll talk about this a lot when like Lucy and Jazz are talking about it too. But like in Verona's story, practice has pretty consistently been like mapping to the ideas of freedom, passion, creativity, and school at the moment is the exact opposite of that for her. And what it's doing is it's making things worse. Like, I'm just talking about how what she's realizing is school is harder because everything else is harder. And what that means is school's worse, which is going to start to bleed into all those other things. Like, it's a fucking, you know, positive feedback loop of awfulness. And it's also just separating her away from practice. And what she's like thinking as she hears, like, I should be in my cool fucking house. I could be in the town I just made. Like, she's, yeah, just sort of, it's separating her from everything. It's going to bleed into everything else. And this is finally all sort of dawning on her, like how these things interact like this. And yeah, it's going to lead up to Sylvia fixing things later, hopefully.
Hopefully. But yeah, like, do you think that's going to be a fix? I mean, I think it will be an improvement because obviously Verona is not, I wouldn't even say flourishing. She's not surviving in this school system, but she's still going to find, you know, economics relatively boring compared to magical economics or whatever.
Yeah, no, for sure. There is a degree to which there's an essence of like a level of, yes, you're going to have to buck up and do shit you don't like. Like,
yeah.
It sucks, but like that's life. We do all have to do that to some degree. But yeah, it's about the fact that like school as an environment is just a really bad fit for her and making that like 100 times harder. Like, yeah. Well, you know, yeah, you're right. She's still going to have to do algebra even if she's homeschooling, and that's still going to suck. But I think it's going to suck a lot less because she can do it on her own time. And Verona seems like the sort who, you know, she can spend the next 2 weeks doing practice or whatever. And I think she is the sort who would eventually be capable of sitting down and cramming for her algebra later, like, you know, when she's not blowing up towns and shit.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do think it's a step in the right direction, so we'll have to see how it plays out, I suppose.
Yeah, but no, you're right. It's not like a magical fix, like suddenly she's going to enjoy all aspects of school. But I think it's the leg up that she needs for it to not be a toothpick under her nail painful. Also, before we move on from here, we should talk about the classic, like, how does what they're learning in the class fit into the story? And I found that hard to do this time because this is the first time they're doing stuff in school that I literally know nothing about. I was very much having the same experience as Verona, where their teacher was throwing around all these terms and I was like, is this English? Honestly, the only thing that I've got is that there's a lot of talk of globalization, and obviously Charles is going for very isolationist-y policies at the moment. So, like, has he underestimated the impact that the loss of trade into and out of the region, practice-wise, it's gonna have, like, how would that be? Because, you know, like, the first thing he did was kick Ray out, and, like, I get his issues with Ray or whatever, but, like, Ray is obviously in the world of the practice, an economical powerhouse. Like,
yeah, and kind of a symbol of globalization of, you know,
yeah,
and transmission of knowledge and all this stuff, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, like with Ray gone, what does this... Yeah, the best thing I can come up with is maybe Charles is underestimating how much the isolationist policies are going to hurt his power.
Mm.
See, I'm easily impressed is trying to explain shit in the chat. I think either that or they're just shit posting, because you've just posted a bunch of words in an order that means nothing to me.
sorry, what?
In the chat, they've said economic globalization is related to trade, while financial globalization would relate more to the dollar being a shared currency and moving capital around. I don't really know what that means.
I mean, yeah, if people want to dive into that, join the Discord. Economic globalization is related to trade, while financial globalization would relate more to the dollar being a shared currency and moving capital around. Okay, so trade versus like... currency exchange and currency exchange.
It's really the last third of that sentence that's losing me.
Yeah, it runs out. I didn't do economics past like year 9, I feel like. Anywho.
No.
So Verona and Macaulay have a pretty fun hangout, and Macaulay is a great friend, offering hugs and intel.
Offering hugs seems like an interesting phrasing for what happens. She kind of gets bullied into a hug or tricked into a hug. I just love that her response to a hug being offered is like, are you attacking me? It's the first of many beats in this segment that are just kind of equal parts hilarious and just tragic. Like, you just feel so sorry for this girl.
Yeah, it's sad. It's a nice moment. I mean, like, it's these two characters who don't have a good grasp on how to be supportive human beings, but they work it out. You know, so thumbs up.
Yeah, like they're not Avery's or Liberty's, so it's just like naturally sort of bubbly people who run around hugging everyone or something. These two are kind of, you know, not the sorts, and plus with their family dynamics, they just like Macaulay's whole thing with the cookies, another hilariously tragic moment where she's like, cookies are a nice thing people do, and it's like, did she see that on a TV show or something? Like, she's just,
yeah, I think so, like a neighbor bringing over cookies or something.
Like, it's just so clear from the minute she pitches it, she just has no idea. And Verona really has to work to be able to say, hey, it's really nice that you thought of that, because she gets so immediately defensive.
Poor Macaulay.
Yeah, hilarious and heartbreaking. And I mean, the other side of that too is like, what just occurred to me reading this section was, I was just reading it and I was like, how has nobody noticed that Macaulay's just been sleeping here? Like, how?
Are we trying to say that her family is not very attentive?
Yeah, like, I don't know. It's just, I know she literally came here because Verona found out her family neglects her, but it's still just crazy to me that in a war zone, she's just able to sleep in the enemy camp and nobody's noticed. Like, that goes beyond neglect to just... And, you know, it goes beyond bad parenting and also becomes bad, like, warrior management. Like, this is bad being a generalism. And I think that, like, that's what's crazy to me is they're not just bad parents, they're bad generals. Which, you know, obviously being a bad parent is worse, but I would have thought at least they'd be good generals.
I don't know. Like, haven't all the main players... been left, you know what I mean? Sorry, not
why,
been,
yeah, her dad
have left with, yeah, exactly. So I feel like it's, I do feel like they're a bit, it's all the B tier, you know, generals, to use your word.
I don't know. I mean, general is probably, I'm more thinking, you know, platoon sergeant or something, but yeah. I thought it was funny because, like, at one point I was like, if they even noticed she was missing, and then later on she says, oh, I'll just tell them I'm at your house again, and they won't be happy, but, you know, Hadley will accept it or whatever. And I was like, oh, cool, so she is at least having to put up a weak facade.
All of Verona's best friends show up to chillax and make weird statements, and should we talk about this one that Melissa says? It's very weird.
I do just want to say, wait, to talk about the wider thing. I do think it's funny that Verona has created a house that's covered in nudie drawings and then is like, and you know, she's created this environment where she's like, hey, be weird, check out my nude drawings. And then people keep saying stuff. And she's like, why do people keep saying weird things in my house?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Verona is somebody who I think we've talked about has struggled with how to have healthy, like, relationship thoughts and stuff, you know. So if the domain is an extension of her, having it be the place where people confess their kind of, let's say, quirkiest relationship reflections and ruminations, I think makes sense.
Yeah, Verona doesn't do small talk. She always tries to cut to the heart of things, and then she's surprised when people say weird shit. It's just funny.
Yeah, I mean, Jalzal also points out that sex was one of the ways she kind of claimed ownership over the space.
Yeah, okay, because I was about to say, I guess it's fair that she's uncomfortable with the weird sex stuff, but you're right. Like, and again, it's covered in nude drawings. Like,
yeah.
It's on people's mind because you've shoved it in their face everywhere.
Like, yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, fun stuff. I do like, you know, we've got Melissa McCauley and Mallory, and it's like the different parts of Kennard and all these bridges being built. And it's fun because, you know, Verona is not the one that we normally would expect this to happen with, but it's nice that she's like, she's building bridges here. She's doing a good job.
Yeah, and because it's all the, like, it's the outsiders, right? Or the people who are struggling to fit in places that she's kind of grouped around herself. Like, you know, you talk about how Verona's not usually the bridge builder. But I think, like, Avery does, as much as Avery is, you know, out there making friends left, right, and center, she has an easier time doing it with, like, you know, other people who are more social, I guess. Whereas, like, Verona has turned into this sort of natural gravity well for all the people who are kind of between places a little bit, and, you know, and her house that is literally between three copies of the town has done the same thing. I don't know. We've talked a lot about how all of these people are, for some reason or another, people who can't quite fit in Kennard above, despite most of them trying to. I think Mal's probably the exception there, but it's like, it's all the people who have fallen out of normal society, and like, it makes sense that these are the people she's kind of, you know, hanging out with, and it's kind of good for all of them.
Yeah, definitely.
And I mean, it obviously contrasts to the school. Like, she was surrounded by a bunch of Kennard above people in the school, and she was miserable. Here she's got these bunch of weirdos talking about incest, and she's far more comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, speaking of how I think it's good for all of them, Bracken comes in and he asks to use the bathroom and to get some water. And like, on my first read, I was like, oh, whatever. And then I really thought about it in the second one. I was like, the Bracken we met in like Lucy's early chapters when she first met him was not the sort of guy to walk around and ask if he could use the bathroom. Like, that's some background character growth right there.
Yeah, he's become a real polite boy.
Yeah.
He's turned into really a real Nick Nelson, if you'll forgive the reference to, I don't think, something that you've seen.
No, I have no idea what that means. But no, it's like, I really am enjoying this vibe of Bracken and Melissa meeting each other halfway between Kennard below and Kennard above. Like, he's trying to integrate into Kennard above, and it seems to be working, and it's helping Melissa too. Like, Yeah.
It's good stuff. I love this bit where Verona says that Jeremy decided to date a horse girl instead of me. And then McCauley says, a horse girl? A centaur? And it's just so dumb.
It's just a stupid joke.
It's very funny. It's a very silly joke. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah,
confirmation that centaurs are real, which is fun. Maybe confirmation that centaurs are real? I don't know. Feel like it maybe couldn't be, but probably is.
Is that something that we needed confirmation on, I guess? I didn't realize it was in doubt. I don't know.
Anywho, back in her drab school life, Verona continues to feel out of place. I think the moment that exemplifies this the best is this moment where Lucy almost goes to hang out with like Jeremy and Wallace, and then Verona sees her, remember, oh wait, Verona's here, and kind of joins up with Verona and two randos.
Yeah. Oh, it's not even that Verona's here. It's that, oh, I can't go there because, like, Jeremy is there. Like, it makes it awkward. But yeah, like this, like that example that you bring up is the part that I think really starts to touch on like something that comes up both in the conversations with Sylvia and with Jazz between each of the girls throughout these chapters, which is forcing Verona to try and fit in at the school like this isn't just hurting Verona, but it's kind of hurting Lucy here too. Like this is like Lucy is kind of making it so she has to choose between hanging out with like her friends and her boyfriend or like separating herself from them to hang out with Verona. Like it's kind of it's not just hurting Verona. Like Lucy is kind of shooting herself in the foot a bit by, you know, trying to force Verona to come to school and stuff. Like it ties into that whole thing. I think, you know, they had the giant fight in arc 12 and 13 that was, you know, exacerbated by the fact that they were sharing a room and so they were spending too much time together and really irritating each other. And it was like, girls, wasn't the moral of that story partially that, you know, some space can be good for your friendship? And I think this is sort of an example of that becoming apparent to the both of them.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's interesting. What does their adult friendship look like, you know? We've had, I think it was in Lucy's last chapter, the thought around, like, their friendship is in a state of evolving and they're too close to, like, not grow back together at some point. But who knows what that looks like. It's
Jasmine touches on it. Nick. Oh, and I think Sylvia does too. Like, this is something we've talked about since, like, arc four, I think, on this podcast, is the idea that they don't have to be attached at the hip, super best friends who are the same about everything for the friendship to not be like real. And I think this is just like the two of them really starting to confront this fact. Because I guess I mean something else that is coming up for Verona right now, like, is the idea of figuring out how to balance things with Lucy and just toe the line with friendships in general is obviously something Verona is still very much figuring out. Like, she talks a lot about how she thinks she's kind of blown things with Tashlet and Tashlet's avoiding her, which honestly, I would not be surprised to learn that Tashlet isn't doing that and it's all in Verona's head. But it's like, you know, Verona talks earlier in the chapter about how she is kind of bad at reaching out and staying in contact with people. And we've seen she built this whole domain and then kind of sat in it and realized, oh, this is quite lonely. So I think, as well as specifically figuring out what her adult relationship looks like with Lucy, I think Verona just in general is still learning how to toe the line of what long-term friendships look like for her in general. And this comes up in the context of Sylvia too.
Yeah. I don't know. It's such a, what do you even call it? Such an adult relationship drama problem.
Yeah, because essentially they're growing apart in a way because they're growing into themselves and they it's not a line I've figured out how to draw. Like, how do you still remain close friends while growing apart like that? It's going to be really interesting to see.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it looks, I don't know, I think in my head I do kind of mentally map a close friendship to one where they hang out all the time and they have all the same interests and do things together.
Yeah,
and
which I don't think it's going to be, right? Yeah.
No, but then, you know, okay, so it's something else, it's something different, it's something new, I'm fully behind that, but at least my instinct is to call that not as close, and I think Pale wants us to think that, you know, those, that doesn't have to be true, but I just don't know what it looks like, so I'm excited to see where it might go.
We will have to kind of keep an eye on it for sure. So Liberty is kind of hanging out with the crew now and having a pretty good time. And it's interesting, Liberty is still talking about, like, you know, I'm not against Massa per se, you know, which is, I guess is the first step towards becoming a full convert, but also is interesting, like, how much is there going to need to be conversations about getting Liberty on board with being anti-Massa? Although, maybe based on the way this chapter ends, that won't be a problem, I don't know.
Yeah, I think we've seen that from a lot of the Kennedy allies, like, this feels like the same position Nicolette is in, like Zed even. Although I think Zed is a little bit more anti-Massa than pretty much everyone else we've talked to recently. But like, yeah, it's hard to fault practitioners spending at least a chunk of time in this space of, look, I'm willing to help you guys out and you know, be a bit of a voice on your behalf. But like, I'm not going to go anti-Massa and just, you know, put it, you know, death sentence on my life and my career. Like, it's kind of hard to fault someone not just immediately being like, yeah, I'm anti-Musa, you know, I don't care that he'll send 70 practitioners after me to kill me.
Yeah, no, it's I'm sure it will turn around.
I feel like Anthem's done a lot of the work there for us by the end of this week's chapters.
Yeah, definitely. Although maybe Anthem will come back and be nice and we'll see.
Yeah, maybe.
We get a good breastbiter shout out here. Tragic. Miss that guy.
He was the best.
Mm.
The world is a darker, slightly raised piece of skin without him.
Mm. Yeah. Poor guy. Back home, VD rears its ugly head before Verona jumps onto a call with her mum.
I love the setup for this where it's like, oh, your mum, like something important's happened. And Verona is like freaking out about it. And then she calls her mum and she's like, what is it? What's important? Her mum's like, oh, yeah, sorry. No, I just, your dad seemed annoyed. So I told him that to make sure he'd definitely tell you. Otherwise, I thought he might not part us on the message. And Verona like calms down in response to this. And I was just giggling because like Verona's like, what a whirlwind. And I was like, that is the most Verona shit to do that I've ever heard of, though. Like Sylvia accidentally causing Verona to panic just because she was like, ah, better tell him he's important. So he passes it along.
Mm, yeah.
And I mean, that's probably my summary of this section. I had to physically stop myself pulling out about 50 quotes where I was just like, oh my God, Sylvia is so much like Verona. Like, there's just, I mean, she even talks about how she might be slightly aromantic too. And we'll get to that. All the stuff with the homework. Like, there's just so much here where I just wanted to pull it out because this phone call is, it's so good and so heartwarming and cathartic after the rest of this chapter.
It's so clear that Verona and her mum are very similar, and that is what helps. I mean, like, you know, it's Verona feels like nobody has quite gotten it and quite gets her, and this clearly is her being got, and that's kind of what she needs, right?
Yeah. And I mean, this has just been the thing with her and her mum. It's just it's been such a bumpy road to get them here, but like as it is happening on this phone call, and I feel like we say this almost every time she has a big phone call, so it's just like, oh, thank God. I did skip one part of the notes I just noticed, which is when Brett does show up and he's all like, you gotta build a bed in the basement so we can, you know, rent it out, blah blah blah, and you know, all this dumb nonsense. She kind of is telling him to fuck off and, you know, saying like good luck with putting that bed together and all that. And then she notices him noticing that she's like rubbing her sore hand, and she suddenly changes everything to like maybes. And that just broke my heart a little bit because I was like, oh, like she noticed her dad maybe seeing her being weak. And so she comes closer to agreeing to the stuff just to make him go away.
Yeah.
To cover it up. And it was just like, oh, like as much progress as Verona makes in this chapter, I'm still like, God, this insecurity she has around being perceived as like competent and strong just like continues to upset me.
Yeah, no, it's, you really feel. You really feel the dynamic here and how rough it is. Like, you're right. This, her reluctance to appear weak is so, and it, the fact that it makes her give in to her shitty dad, it's rough.
Yeah. So I'm easily impressed, just brought up in the chat, but also he's setting up this room to rent it out. Who the fuck is renting in Kenneth right now? It's such a good point. Like, half the town has just moved out. There's so many empty houses. Like, the rental market in Kennett must be like a 3-bedroom house for about $20 a month. It also just like, I get that, you know, Brett is constantly going on about how they're struggling financial and whatever. So like, I do understand that, you know, sometimes this sort of thing is necessary, but just the idea of having somebody else like living in the basement like that is such a, it fundamentally changes how much the house is going to feel like theirs if you have a tenant who can like walk through the living room at any point. Like, I don't know, maybe just because I grew up in the country where we never really had to do that sort of thing. I'm just a bit like spoiled or whatever, but I was just like, I don't know, like it feels like Verona has always struggled with feeling like she had any sense of her own space in this house. And I feel like having a tenant living in the basement would make that 100 times worse.
Yeah. Rough. I like Giles Arl has called out that maybe Edith could,
That thought did just cross my mind too.
And then, you know, we'd have Matthew and Louise, and we'd have Edith and VD, which is the dream team. Yeah, no, that'd be very funny. Yeah, then there's this other section. I want to talk about this bit where we get, rather than the kick, kick, kicks, we get TikTok, TikTok in this bit where Verona is starting to chat to her mum. And it's so interesting. It's like an extension of the kick, 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 tentatively moving in the right direction.
Yeah, well, I think there are a few TikToks in the school part too.
I might have missed those.
So, like, I think it's all, like, tying in. But you're right. Wait, there's none of the kick, kick, kicks. It's just the TikToks, which are better because they're not
evoking
fingernails.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, these parts are also tied into that moment where, yeah, like, she's worried that something has happened to her mom. And so it's just, like, I think it's just, like, emblematic of the tension that she feels right there, which is all leading to this misdirect of, like, this phone call starts and Verona's panicking and you're like, oh God, is this going to be more stress? And that's all just so Wildbo can trick you. And actually this phone call is delightful and pressure relieving.
Mm.
It's like a good prank to pull on us. You know, it's not like the usual thing where, you know, I mean, I feel like it turns Wildbo out to be worse.
Like sets up it does emotionally draining situations and then lets us get a bit of catharsis to resolve it. But you're right. Sometimes it's the opposite.
He just likes tricking us.
Yeah. But so, yeah, Verona and her mum connect before she rejoins the crew as Anthem prepares to re-enter Kennet. Should we talk about the homeschooling suggestion? Because I do think it's a really good one from her mum. Like, it's a great...
Well, we've talked about it in the past,
fair
too.
Enough. Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, like, it just... Cause
it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah, we originally talked about it in the context of, like, Avery had done homeschooling and it didn't seem to suit her and she's, like, thriving in a school environment.
Yes.
And Verona is the opposite. And you know, I've always really liked the way that Pale has, you know, been talking about stuff like how one size fits all doesn't make sense. And so you can have a kid where homeschooling was bad, but you can also have a kid where you can just point at them and be like, oh, you know, some sort of distance education or homeschooling makes way more sense for Verona. So yeah, like it's just good to finally see somebody in the story also being on that same page, because the way Sylvia frames it, you can just see, like, it's just like, oh, this kind of has to be it.
Yeah I mean, like, you know, the criticism of generalized schooling like this is that it is too blunt to account for you know, the uniqueness of some children, and Verona is, you know, the textbook case for that, right?
Yeah, and I also think, like, just, like, I think one of the big arguments in my mind for schools, and this has come up in the context of the Blue Heron in this story, is the social aspect. Like, the value proposition for especially, you know, people like the Hennigers and stuff can be, a more well-rounded social experience.
Mm.
But that doesn't work for everyone. Like, Verona is just not that. Like, I don't know, like, she's just not someone, she's never fit in with Kennet above, and like Macaulay is kind of another example, and she was the one it really came up with in terms of Ray and his interlude. Like, for someone like Avery, that's the big proposition for traditional schooling in my mind, but it doesn't suit everyone.
Yeah Well, we'll see. It feels like the kind of thing that, like, I don't know. Yeah, again, I feel like I say this a lot, though, of, like, I don't know if this is actually going to be able to play into the story in the immediate sense, but it is, like, a good setup for leaving the characters in a happier place.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, I mean, Anthem is preparing to arrive in Kennet, and we'll cover that in a moment.
Yeah. It's time for Daddy Teddy to arrive.
Yep, that's what we call him. That's what he demands we refer to him exclusively as, Daddy Teddy. So yeah, in 18.7, we're with Lucy, and Liberty is arriving for dinner, bringing guests who are on their best behavior.
This is such a fucking wild idea. Like, I do love that Lucy keeps being like, I got to get my mom into this world, got to get her more comfortable, so yeah, I'll let Liberty have goblins over for dinner. Like, it's just... It wouldn't be your first thought, but it does seem to be working.
Yeah. yeah, it's very fun that these goblins come over for dinner. And it really is, like, again, a great building bridges moment of, like, Jasmine is now kind of making connections to some local, somewhat nice goblins. And like Jasmine is obviously a bit iffy about them to start, but kind of warms to them over time a bit, not fully, but you know, good enough. And it's, yeah, it's just nice. It's just nice stuff.
Yeah, I think it's that thing where it's helping her see others as just like people. And, you know, they don't have to be people she wants to go have a beer with. Like, not everyone has to get on with everyone. But, like, this is the sort of thing that's helping Jazz get to the point of, like, our goblins are just like people, you know. I don't have to have them in my house or whatever, but, like, I will respect their right to exist sort of deal. Which, you know, Jasmine's not the sort of person who it's going to be particularly difficult to get her over that hurdle, I don't think. But, yeah, like, just, you know, being able to engage with them like that, I think is just an important good step. It's nice to see Liberty helping it along.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, goblins being on their best behavior is peak comedy. There's this bit where Lewd Tube, they're talking about America needing a chill pill, and Lewd Tube says, chill pill up the street. There might be a pharmacy. I wonder if they sell them there. It's just so silly.
What a
it's
save.
A perfect save.
Yeah, the whole thing with Lewd Tube and this quote-unquote prank that they're pulling where they're being nice, but they're also subverting the normal joke because it's not being nice leading up to a prank. They're going to be ironic and not do a punchline. Like, it's just, it's so funny. And, like, Lewd Tube is just constantly losing her mind at this prank, like when she's being polite and then she's just like giggling to herself, like, and it's like, oh, you don't have the like the intellectual high ground here, Lewd Tube, like you think you do. And even Flopsy's like groaning at them. It's just so funny.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Like the bit where she corrects Liberty for saying balls or whatever. She's like so proud of herself. It's like such an idiot. I love it.
Yeah, it's very fun.
Can we talk about, so okay, they're talking about like Liberty's sharpened teeth, and Jasmine is like, so does that hurt? And Liberty's like, yeah, sometimes if I breathe in wrong or drink something cold, because there's nerves exposed here and there. But it's worth it. How is it worth it? What are the
for
pros
the visuals, for the fucking aesthetic, Elliot.
Oh, I suppose this is like, I'm quite anti-piercing, but just from a, that shit seems like it would hurt, and I don't, so I'm not anti-piercings on other people. If other people want to get pierced, like, whatever, I you know, visually or whatever, I'm not too fussed either way. Just like, for me personally, I'm very anti-piercing because I'm just like, why would I poke myself like that? That hurts. And maybe this is just the goblin extension of that. Why would you sharpen your teeth? Because it hurts just for an aesthetic thing.
Yeah, for the aesthetic. I mean, you know, this is Liberty who, Liberty in America went to all the effort to make sure that they could do kind of anime girl transformations with their goblins. Like, that's a lot of effort, but, you know, it's for the aesthetic. And we're in the, you know,
but
we're
it
in
doesn't
the
hurt and it's not permanent.
The aesthetics in the other verse are big, you know, big ups to your power. I don't know what this picture that TreeFS has just posted. I have no idea what that's meant to be. Let's move on.
I like this moment, actually, where Jasmine, Liberty's like explaining how she travels between, you know, the various houses her family owns. And Jasmine's like, oh, were you all on your own? And Liberty's like, yeah, yeah, but like, it's cool because, you know, I've got wilderness training, so I can survive pretty much anywhere. And I was just like, oh, wow, you totally misunderstood why Jasmine ask that question there, Liberty. Like, that's not, she wasn't asking whether you're physically capable of surviving.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, from this kind of stuff, the conversation turns to family, talking about America, and obviously from that, Alexander Bellanger. And there are minefields here that are mostly avoided.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because it's like they've kind of flip-flopping over each other's minefields. Like, Liberty keeps bringing up Alex, which Lucy hates, so she's trying to change the topic. So she kind of invariably keeps taking it back to Toad Swallow adjacent topics, which is Liberty's minefield. And it's like, it's just funny because it's really hard because Alex and Toad Swallow are basically the only two points of comparison that they have for each other. That's what they have in common. So they're kind of inevitable overlaps in the discussion on stuff, but neither of them is willing to talk about one of them.
Yeah, it's very funny, isn't it? They're both kind of trying to steer the conversation away from the thing that they find, you know, they don't want to talk about, and it leads to quite a fun dynamic in the conversation.
Yeah, because it's just, it kind of keeps going back and forth between them.
Yeah. There's... should we touch on, reflecting on the fact that Lucy was involved in the death of Alexander Bellanger, like, I feel like this is something Lucy needs to be able to talk to Jasmine about, but she's too worried about Jasmine, you know, coming down hard on her for it I don't know.
She does say she plans on telling her, just like, not right now. Like, she's waiting for a calmer time to mention that John killed Alexander.
Will there ever be a calmer time, Elliot?
Exactly. I remember Avery going through this in Arc 13 with telling everyone she was going to move. I don't know. I mean, this is the interesting thing, is like, there is this layer of, the Kennedys have told their parents a lot, and, you know, we're constantly hearing about the notes they've shared, but I think in almost every chapter of Arc 18, we've had at least one moment where a Kenneteer has gone, oh, we haven't told them about X or Y yet. Like, the parents are being brought up to speed very quickly, but also, like, the Kenneteers are being very tactical in keeping some of the worst for last.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it plays out, I suppose. But I doubt there will ever be a quieter time. Also, we get Paul being brought up at this part of the chapter, which feels very tactical by Wildbo, just kind of seeding more discussion of bad fathers, or more, like, you know, topics on bad fathers, which will obviously be very important in this chapter for Lucy. It's great stuff.
Well, yeah, because, like, Lucy's, like, entire rogues gallery of bad father figures sort of comes up as well, because Guillemay also gets a brief mention from Jazz a couple of times. John obviously comes up in the context of, like, shooting Alexander. Like, all of Lucy's sort of failed father figures get little mentions, which is, as you say, is kind of priming us to compare this to Anthem later on. We'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get to the end of the chapter, I suppose.
Something that I do want to call out, even though it's more of a last chapter thing, but something Liberty does talk about here is, like, you know, her array of private tutors that are kind of set up to teach her and America stuff. And, you know, she doesn't really like it because it feels so soulless, and she only really liked Toadslaw because he's such, like, an engaging teacher and actually cares about them as people. But I do like this. The topic of Verona and how to handle her from a Lucy perspective comes up a number of times in this chapter. And I think, honestly, like, this conversation with Liberty here is starting to seed the idea in Jasmine and Lucy's heads that there are alternatives to just going to school. Because I think Verona talked about it last chapter, but a big reason she does still go to school and why she was at school in the previous chapter is because she told Jasmine and Lucy she would. Like, as much as it's a Verona moment for her to realize she doesn't have to go to school and to find a better alternative for herself, and that'll be a growth moment for her, the angle of Jasmine and Lucy accepting it is going to be a factor there, because, like, what they think matters to Verona, and, like, them supporting this will mean a lot to her. So to a certain degree, like, getting Jasmine and Lucy on board with the idea of Verona not going to school is going to be a thing, and I think it'll be slightly easier to get Jasmine on board than Lucy, but talks like this and, you know, just seeding the idea in their heads that there are different methods feels important.
I agree. Like, I think it's the kind of thing where I don't know if Verona is going to be confident enough to push for this by herself, especially not when almost certainly VD is not going to want to take the effort to do it. So without Sylvia, or probably Sylvia and Jasmine kind of pushing for it and working for it with Verona, it's probably not going to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think even if Jasmine and Lucy weren't necessary, like, if Lucy took the stance that Verona is abandoning her at school, like, that would really fuck Verona up. So, like, I think their support is just going to matter from a morale perspective, even if they're not necessary to make it happen. And I mean, I guess while we're here, we may as well talk about, like, this is conversation that gets cut in two, but happens throughout this chapter, which is like Jasmine and Lucy talking a bit about Verona. And it feels like Jasmine is doing sort of the other side of what Sylvia was doing last chapter, which is preparing Lucy for the idea that they can still be close friends, but it doesn't have to look like what it did. Like, you know, it's all tying into the coming of age side of Pale. Jasmine is working to sort of, you know, express to Lucy that, like, you know, Verona is changing and that doesn't have to be a bad thing. You can still find a balance that's a different and a new one.
Jasmine decides she wants to come along for this showdown with America, so Lucy heads upstairs to prep.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, yeah, we'll get to it more when Anthem shows up properly, but there's this fun juxtaposition of, like, Lucy tells her mom, no, I don't want you to come to this fight. And Jasmine's like, I hear you. bad luck. And it's this really fun, because, like, this is Jasmine completely ignoring Lucy's wishes, but coming from a place of, A, genuinely listening to her and acknowledging that she listened to her, and B, doing it because she cares about her and refuses to not be engaged. And, like, yeah, I like, you know, that's just such a fun comparison to Anthem, who's not going to listen to Liberty, but in a way that's way shittier soon. Like, Jasmine is ignoring Lucy, but in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. it's kind of funny, isn't it? Like, I love that this chapter and the previous chapter really do demonstrate to us Verona and Lucy are just so similar to their mothers.
Yeah.
In very fun ways. I love this moment where Jasmine is, like, drawing these runes onto Lucy. It's such a interesting visual of Lucy, of Jasmine's acceptance of, like, Lucy's being a wizard. But also, like, Lucy notes how it's colder than other similar things, like Jasmine helping with her hair, for example. I think it's just, like, yeah, I find it very interesting. I feel like it's such a cool visual that I would love to see adapted.
Yeah, I agree, because, well, yeah, it's such a powerful moment, because I think Lucy and her, like, bulletproof look have been a thing, you know, the entire story. And this is such a, like, great extension of it, because she's, like, literally putting her warrior armor suit on. Like, she turns her sweater into, like, some chainmail stuff. So she's kind of literally making herself bulletproof. And the other big side of her being bulletproof was that she didn't have enough backup. And now, like, she's got her mom and she's got Liberty, like, helping her prepare. And it's just such a big moment for her in her character journey, and just also her relationship with her mom, as you mentioned, like the fact that, you know, she compares it to her mom helping her with her hair, but it's like this like next level of that.
But the coldness, the fact that she thinks it's colder is, yeah, that's the key to me that makes it very interesting.
You're right. I mean, it is helping her to prepare for, I guess this is that, like, thing of Jasmine helping her with her hair was very much like a mom doing a mom thing to help her daughter. Mm. Whereas this is more the relationship has shifted. Pale's a coming of age story, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, the relationship with your parents changes and becomes more equitable. And I think, like, this is that, like, it's still her mom, but also, like, things have shifted, and you know, now it's not just helping her get her hair ready, it's like helping her go to war. Is sort of, yeah, not as much of a mum thing. It's a different type of relationship too.
Very true.
I really, really like the ending to this segment too. Like, talking about powerful imagery, the idea that, like, Lucy sort of finishes getting ready and is sort of saying, you know, nobody watches me, I just watch myself, because everyone is kind of watching me, but in a toxic way. And I, you know, I need to be good enough to be bulletproof. And Jasmine's like, that's not the world I wanted for you. And then, like, Lucy activates her runes and is like, me either. And I was like, fuck, that was like, like, that's the ending to an episode right there. Like, that moment gave me goosebumps.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very good moment, isn't it? And it really perfectly sums up Lucy's whole thing of, like, she wants to fight to make the world a better place so that she doesn't have to be the one, or people like her don't have to be the ones to fight to make the world a better place. It's so good.
Yeah. It's just such a badass, strong moment of, like, yeah, she's become the person who, yeah, is just going to be able to fight for things to be better.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, the gang heads out and they're prepping for America's arrival.
Yeah, and they meet up with Verona. Like, this is sort of where we intersect with where the last chapter ends. And I've been meaning to mention this for weeks, but I keep skipping it over in our notes. But I'm really enjoying this background joke of Verona, like, you know, doing a Khaleesi and gathering these stupid titles for herself. So introducing her becomes like a gargantuan effort.
Mm.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Talking about how Verona is like struggling with insecurity around being taken seriously and all that. It's funny how, you know, she's currently manifesting that in the form of just like trying to build a big list of all her accolades and titles.
Mm. Yeah. It is quite fun. Maybe one day she'll get to be her own slayer who slavishly slays, but not yet.
I mean, it's going to reach the point where, like, Khaleesi in the books and show, she's going to need somebody to introduce her, because it'll be somebody's job to remember all the titles.
Yeah, she'll need a, what do you call them, like a trumpeter
yeah,
welcome her whenever she walks into a new room.
Yeah, if we get Pekka's not the ability to talk.
Yeah. I want to talk about, like, Lucy's vibe this chapter, because it's really, I found it really interesting. Like, I found it kind of so dour in such a strong way. Like, it felt like, until we get to the end, at least, where we get a bit more kind of determination coming in, she felt to me kind of defeated. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It was just this kind of overall vibe rereading this chapter of, like, Lucy just feels like she's in such a grim place, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't fully agree. I agree with grim. I definitely think she's in... I feel like the word, if I had to summarize it in one word, it would be determined.
Mm.
This chapter, like, I think she's just, in the chapter we talked about last week, there was obviously all the thoughts about Logan, and I know from your notes, like, we're going to talk about all that stuff, yes, later on, obviously, but, like, so much of that chapter was building around the idea that, like, Lucy hated the fact that, you know, before she couldn't fight, and that chapter essentially ended with her being on the note of thinking, I am now somebody who can change things and fight back.
Mm.
And I think what we're seeing is just, like, you know, her, I guess, getting ready to do that. This is...
Yeah, this, maybe this that is what is it her, is.
Like, Lucy, like, you know, before Verona does a big thing, Verona gets more silly and is going to make stupid jokes. And Avery is kind of turning into that too. Whereas, like, Lucy gets serious. Like, this is her sort of, like, you know, like, I think the term resting bitch face sort of thing has been thrown around. Like, I think as she's getting ready for a big fight like this, she's just, yeah. I like resolute is being thrown around by Mirthstrike in the chat. I like that word too.
Yeah.
Like, I think she's just mentally preparing herself for, you know, to fight.
Yeah, I get that. Maybe that is what I'm kind of vibing from here, but it feels different to me, the end where she's on her kind of judicial crusade vibes, which is my favorite type of Lucy. It just feels,
yeah,
like she's so worn down, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, this isn't a fight she wants to do, I guess. Like, you're right. She's not, this isn't a fight she's jonesing for, right? This is like a, she hates that she has to do this. She hates that, you know, she's going to have to watch Liberty get crushed probably twice, which is exactly what happens. Like, yeah, like, I think Lucy's ramp up and prep for this fight is kind of sour, because it is, because, you know, yeah, she's not looking forward to it.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. But yeah, we get to the chat between America and Liberty, and it's kind of sad. Neither of them is able to make any progress on convincing the other. Just glum. I mean, you know, Lucy this whole chapter is kind of in her head thinking, like, all right, well, you can try it, Liberty, but I'm ready to fuck her up when it doesn't work.
Yeah, and Verona was right. Verona was the same in the previous chapter. Like, Liberty's, yeah, like, yeah, I'll talk to my dad. And Verona's like, yeah, dad talk, that'll go great.
Yeah, no, she's like, I'll talk to my dad and he'll back down. And they're kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
like, both of them very much had zero faith this was going to work. It's just, it would be shit to Liberty to not give her the chance.
Yes, for sure.
As much as this hurts her. Yeah. Fucking America, I just can't. I think I finally reached the point where it's like, if America flips around and starts being chill again, up until now, for the whole story, I've been like, oh, when America turns around and stops being a dick, it'll be like, she'll be great fun. It'll be just like Shelley. I think we finally crossed the threshold where I'm like, oh, America needs a serious timeout before I'm willing to put up with her bullshit again.
It's a tragic scene here, isn't it? Like, you really feel, not just from Liberty, but from both of them, how sad this is, right? And I feel like the problem is America is arguing from the position of stick with the family, and Liberty has kind of been on board with that, clearly, because she's so always so willing to defend, you know, America and her dad. But stick with the family at its core assumes your family aren't the villains. And, you know,
yeah,
a lot of these deals that Liberty has made are from the perspective of the family is always right, and that just doesn't apply anymore. And it's pretty sad.
Yeah, like this whole conversation really is sort of the resolution to all of the stuff that was driving 8.A, like the Liberty interlude in Arc 8, which, holy shit, was 10 arcs ago. But like that arc, oh, sorry, that interlude chapter all that time ago had so much of Liberty kind of being bossed around by America, and she drew that line when she was meant to beat the shit out of Avery. And yeah, it really sort of, this whole chat comes from this framing of like Liberty making it clear America has always been pulling this shit, like very big sibling energy from America of like using this stuff to get her way all the time and not really having an equitable relationship with Liberty. And it just, yeah, I mean, it's such a good example of what sucks about the seal, because this was like a childhood promise to always have each other's backs. And like, when you first hear that, you're like, how could that not be just a good, wholesome thing to do? But now it's turned into this where they basically have to kind of agree to not directly harm each other, because otherwise they'll both be forsworn, but essentially admit that they're done.
Yeah. Which is pretty rough.
Yeah. It just, it sucks.
Yeah, it really does.
And I mean, yeah, like not, I mean, it also sucks because you can see America's side. Like, America's obviously wrong, but like the world has gone to shit around her, and the tribalism is an easy thing to fall back on. So I get how you can frame it as like Liberty is just making things more complicated than they need to be. But it's a very Rook argument. Like, this is the same argument Rook used to make her deal with Edith.
Yeah, it's It's these arguments that are very much relying on the kind of systemic things that practitioner society has built up, right? And that's the failing, and the misalignment between the two of them is Liberty is now on the side of not wanting that anymore.
Yeah, yeah, basically. And because, like, America keeps quoting this, you know, zombie survival guide they made, which just, like, as an aside, I love how goblin practitioners are still very much practitioners. Like, you know, they're not quoting you know, proper court precedent like someone like Musa does. What they did was write a stupid little book as kids, but now they are still quoting it as like, you know, a legal document or like scripture. Like, they are, you know, remember chapter 3.3? Oh, that doesn't apply here. Like, it's still doing practitionary shit, but just in a goofy context. But yeah, like, it is still like, I mean, I get like, this is that thing, like, they're still practitioners, so still so much of it is open to interpretation, and you can kind of see where America's coming from, but it's so clear that Liberty is trying to be better, and America has given up on trying that.
Yeah, yeah, it seems so. But, you know, she's now going to have to do some improvement courses, so maybe she will get better. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, because, like, you know, I think we've been very clear on this podcast way back in the day, like, how much I'm anti-punitive justice, and very much restorative justice is the way to go. Someone like America or Eastern taking the civility course feels like the real test of how much this civility course can achieve in terms of restorative justice.
I think it's going to do it. I think it'll be so fucking funny if they come back from the courses and they're just like really nice and have completely turned around. How would that not be the fucking most hilarious thing?
It just seems so unrealistic, though. Like a
great team member and ally, as does America. Yeah,
Easton coming back as a dude who accepts his civic responsibility would be such a fucking whiplash turnaround.
Yeah, and is like, oh, what? You know, like, I was coming.
I'm sorry for the misogynistic
sexuality around Musa, and like, I've been starting to deal with that, and I really apologize. Like, Oh, such good stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I just don't trust. Pale's been very clear in the past that it's like really hard to help people who don't want help. And I think Eastern in America.
Yes, for sure. They don't. I know. I know. But it like would just Miles, be so funny, Elliot. Right?
It would be. But like Miles Sutton is the sort of person who I think is going to walk out of it a better person.
Mm. Yeah. And it already seems to be kind of having that effect on him with like, you know, with Biscuits interlude and stuff.
But I have less faith for them. But yeah, well, fucking prove me wrong, miss. Please. One last section I want to call out here from like Mary and Liberty sort of having this fight about their stuff is America kind of brings up why the book applies and blah, blah, blah. And Lucy's like, oh, does that change things for you, Liberty? And Liberty's like, no, because I think she's just being a butt and it doesn't feel right. And that's when she turns it around and blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, fuck, she really has been hanging out with Avery. Like, with the core facet of your argument is that just doesn't feel right, and I think you're being an asshole. Like, that's almost word for word what Liberty has said to people like Florida.
Yeah. This doesn't go very well, so Lucy decides to step in, fighting against America and Slagar, who slavishly slays. And he's a fun character, isn't he? Slagar, who slavishly slays, forcing people to say his name and basically the fight coming down to a few attempts to take away Lucy's ability to say his name, like, and so that he gets an advantage. Like, that's very fun. Also, the text refers to him with his full title the whole time, except one that I saw, which I think was a mistake, because it's much better if it's always Slagar who slavishly slays, just to really drive home how clunky it makes you deal with him. It's great. It's wonderful.
It's such a funny shtick, like, to make saying your name, just something everyone has to do. Like, it's such a fun way to take control of the verbal side of fights, which obviously in this world is such an important part. Like, the coup and claim that goes on when people are exchanging words in a fight is so important. Mm. So you can see why this dude who's making everyone say his name all the time gets a lot of value out of it. And, you know, fits very well into a lot of the stuff about, you know, people owning conversations and fights, which is what Lucy hates.
Yeah. And then, of course, the way that the
I thought it was funny that, like, Lucy kept being surprised that he just absolutely shattered all of the glamour shit she was pulling. Like,
yeah.
She sort of made her arena and then he just smashed into it. And she's like, oh, you shouldn't be able to do that. And I was like, yeah, that is impressive. But also, he's a goblin.
He's like a big, strong goblin.
Yeah, top tier goblin. Yeah.
Of course, Lucy uses the strategy that all Kenneteers use to win fights, which is yeet people into Kennet Found and make them take civility courses. The classic way of winning a fight. It's so good. I love it. It's a really fun fight. Like, it's really good shit.
Yeah, it's some fun action. She uses like the time slowdown to great effect. Like, it's pretty cool. And then obviously, like, the central part of it is like this misdirect, which I also wanted to pull out because she said miss twice. And as I was reading it, I was like, it's like miss. And then I was like, no, that's a stupid joke.
Mm.
And then it turns out that was the thing.
Yeah.
I just really enjoyed that was actually the thing.
Yeah. A misdirect. Yeah. Very good. But yeah, it's a very fun fight and it's wonderful. Anthem arrives and basically doesn't engage with Liberty at all, just cuts her off and refuses to speak to her.
I mean, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And you know, like, this is the thing that I love about this chapter is, you know, what this means to Lucy. Like, when I was reading this chapter for the first time, I was like, oh, holy shit, Wabo is so smart for setting it up so that this scene is Liberty and Lucy. And it's like, you know, looking back at the past few chapters, seeing how it's come to this exact moment, and you know immediately what this means to Lucy and how triggering of her being abandoned by a shitty dad instincts this is. It's so pure and wonderfully set up.
Yeah, because like, I remember like a few arcs ago we were really at the point, I remember talking about how, oh well, Anthem wouldn't be a thing yet because he's part of Avery's story, so, you know, Avery will be the one to deal with him.
Mm.
But now that he's had time to sort of be a thing for all of them, you really see how naturally he gravitates towards being this antagonist in Lucy's story the most, because, you know, he's being like an abandoning dad. Like, you know, obviously there's different flavors of bad dad. If you're a clingy bad dad, that's going to be a Verona problem. But if you're an abandoning bad dad, then you're a Lucy problem. And I think, yeah, this is just one of those many examples of, like, I think one of the really, really clever things Pale has done that is honestly often too big brain for me is, like, how so many things fit into multiple Kenneteers stories in different ways. Like, the way Anthem intersects all of their stories. Like, it's not, stuff in this story is never just one thing. Like, Kennet found means different things for Verona and Lucy and fits into both their stories in distinct ways that both make sense and interact. And we're seeing that with Anthem here. Like, an arc ago, if you told me, like, Lucy versus Anthem was the natural big thing, it would have taken me a second to figure out how we got there. But once you see it, you're like, oh, that, of course, that's perfect.
Yeah, it's so perfect. And that's what, that's the strength of Wampa's writing, right? It's like,
yeah,
the way that these threads and character beats will play into each other so perfectly, it's so satisfying.
Yeah, and it's like, because I guess this is his first story with, like, multiple multiple simultaneous protagonists, and this is one of the big things that's allowed him to do, is set up things but create a web, not just like link everything to something the protagonist or you know, one of their sidekicks is going through, but literally introduce something and tie it into multiple. And it's made it really hard to do something like this podcast on the story, because it means, you know, we're not keeping up with them all, or at least I'm not, but like, it's such a strength in the story that things fit in multiple ways like this, and it just creates such a coherent whole.
It's very good.
As Liberty, you know, gets shat on by Anthem, Toadswallow and Bubblegum finally sort of show up and take her in, and it's just such a moment, because we obviously talked around the Toadswallow awkwardness, because Liberty's always been really upset about the way he abandoned her, and we knew why, but she didn't. And just the moment of when Anthem fucks up, Toadswallow is just there, and it has that moment of, like, I always fucking cared and I didn't want this, but, like, it's just, he's such a good guy. Fucking love Toadswallow. Like, he's Toadswallow, the dad best Liberty goblin deserves.
Yeah, Toadie is great. Lucy refuses to let Anthem leave with this, so forces him to stop and demands he acts like a father. And he says, no way. No thanks.
I really, like, Lucy started chasing the car, and I was like, oh, we're really doing this? And then Anthem gets out of the car, and he's like, you really want to do this? I was just like, okay, good. It's not just me. Like, I genuinely did think we were just going to let Anthem get away with this at the time. And then Lucy started chasing him, and I was like, oh, fuck. Like, this is such a shit intense moment. And then it was so funny that Anthem sort of expresses that too, because this is just such a wild play to come after Anthem like this. I love it.
It is wild, isn't it? And that's why it's so compelling, right? Is because, like,
it's so good. Yeah.
I really love that this is kind of undeniably, from a, like, tactical standpoint, a really bad decision, but from a Lucy standpoint, of course she's going to do it, and it's so wonderful that she does. Like, it's so on brand for her. And, like, I get, like, on the subreddit, there's been a lot of doubt about whether Lucy can actually win this, and, like, it's probably right that Lucy can't win a straight up fight here, but I just love it so much, and I think Lucy is so clever and has so many tricks up her sleeve that I think even if she isn't going to win this fight in the way that you might anticipate, she is going to. There's going to be she's going to get some kind of, you know, I believe in her getting some kind of win here.
Yeah.
I believe in Lucy is what I'm saying.
Because, well, there's two big things to talk about here. There's, like, the symbolism of Lucy accepting this fight, and then there's also the talk about how can she possibly win.
Well, and they're together, because, like, the symbolism of her picking this fight and then losing, I think, is also going to be important if that's how it goes.
Yeah. Well, it's like, because this is like this just feels to me like it's going to be a massive moment in Lucy's character arc that she's even doing this fight. Like, I think I'm on team she's going to kind of get a victory. But like kind of regardless, this is just like, as you touched on, like Lucy trying to fight the injustice of the world has been such a huge core part of her entire character arc, and like trying to figure out a way to do that without becoming overly violent and resentful has been so much. And like Anthem is standing in for all the shittiness of the world, and then also people who aren't doing right by their family. Like, he's become this symbol of both what's wrong with the world and what's wrong with individuals. Like, he just, you know, in very quickly has become such this perfect villain for most of what her character arc has been leading towards. And, well, yes, yeah, so of course she has to fight him. Like, it's just, it's such a perfect moment where I was like, oh, this fight means so much to Lucy in her journey in a really powerful way.
Yeah.
I'll be shocked if this isn't the next chapter.
Yeah, no, I agree. If we cut away to an interlude now, I swear to God.
I mean, parallel that jumped out to me as I was sort of reading Anthem running away is I was like, this is also just touching on that wound she's still dealing with John. Like, this is Anthem ignoring Liberty and abandoning her is kind of touching on the same nerve as John leaving her to go to the Carmine trial. And part of why I bring that up is because it ties into, I'm very much on team. I think she has to get some sort of victory out of this, like maybe not without some sort of cost or whatever, but like, I think she's going to have to get something out of this. And I was trying to think how she can possibly do that against Anthem. And the thing that immediately jumped into my brain was like the arena she conjured up when she was fighting John, which was the one that was a contest of wills, not like an actual like violence fight. And so like, that's my guess as to how she can possibly try and get one over on Anthem. Is I don't think she'll do it with violence. But if she does, because Anthem's been too built up. It would be kind of insane to me if she just beats him in a fight. I think there will be an aspect of fighting. She will need to use her physical capabilities to avoid getting killed by him in 2 seconds. Like, you know, all that Guillaume training isn't going to be wasted, because it's going to be what allows her to survive for more than 5 seconds against him. But I don't think she's going to beat him in a fight. If the best guess I have is that she's going to create something like the Arena of Wills to make it more of a contest of like what's right. Because I think, it's going to have to come down to the fact that, she's right and he's wrong. And if she can make that somehow like a core tenet of what decides this fight, that would be the only way she can get through.
Yeah, I think so. We'll see, I suppose, how it's gonna play out. But I'm very hyped for it.
Oh, same.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the end of our chapters for this week. But there's still more to come, because we've still got some Pale predictions to revisit. Predictions from the community that have been left in our Pale Predictor form to get points. And you get more points the better your predictions are, and whoever gets the most points wins a keychain. So if you want to get your chance of winning the keychain,
that's a bad joke, because genuinely we are planning to give out prizes during all packs.
Oh wait, are we? Oh
yeah.
Okay, well you might actually get a keychain.
Did you forget?
I did forget that.
I can't say what they are because we're not meant to talk about them. But yeah, no, there are genuinely going to be prizes for various prediction categories during that stream. So there are genuine prizes on the line.
Yep, so put in your predictions and you might win a keychain or other.
Or a real prize.
How dare you, Elliot? I would love a Pale Predictions keychain.
I mean, could I suppose we could
picture
look at
of a Kenneteer on it. Yeah. If you want, you can leave a prediction in our new prediction category, which is predicting what the prizes are going to be. anywho, I put out a prediction from Belegtal, which I really loved this week, which is that Liberty, accepting her role as kind of a member of Kennet, will become the BSW's chosen successor as one of the warlords of the Undercity, so that BSW can go and be Nicolette's apprentice. And I really love this. Like, perfect as a fit for Libs, right? Like, It again, and I say this a lot, I feel like it's probably a setting up the end of the story type of thing rather than a we're going to have the arc of Liberty in the Undercity type of thing. But I do love it conceptually. I think it would fit so nicely with Liberty's place as a, you know, member of Kennet.
I don't know. I think, you know, for a change of pace, Wild Bo could do an arc that was about a teenage girl being a warlord in a post-apocalyptic hellscape.
He's never written that about that kind of stuff before, has he?
That would be nice new ground to tread.
Controlling things that most of society looks down on or ignores.
Yeah, she controls gross little creatures. Yeah.
So stupid.
Such a dumb joke. I very much like vibe with this more from like I think Toadsaw would be the other candidate for her replacement. Just because there's been so much talk of him potentially joining the council, and I think Gob, like I don't know if I've gone through it on the podcast or not, but like my whole theory about like the conceptual overlap between Undercity people and goblins, and how Undercity people are like on the spectrum towards goblins from you know innocent humans, but like goblins are such a natural fit for the Undercity. I think it makes sense to have them on the council, but it feels weird for Toad Swallow to be one of the warlords too. Like he's already trying to juggle the market and everything. So like Liberty as an alternative, really I vibe with. And also just as a fuck you to Charles to have a practitioner be on the council for his, you know, bullshit pre-seal hellscape is just funny. So I just also like it as a fuck you to Charles.
Yeah, no, I think it's very good. I really do like this one. So well done, Beleg Tal. Keychain to come.
I've pulled out a prediction from Captain Rhino, who predicts that one of the ways Lucy might be able to win this fight against Anthem is if she prays to her local god of blood and violence, Marisica. And, you know, that god will provide her with a power boost that she can use to beat Anthem. Which is a wild fucking prediction that does make, like, if Lucy was going to win this with blood and violence, I mean, that's the way it's going to happen. Captain Rhino does specify that they don't necessarily think Lucy will take her up on this offer, but they think Marisica might make the offer. And that does make sense. Like this feels like a perfectly Marisica moment to appear and make some shitty offer like that.
What would it be? I don't know. It is kind of wild. And I don't think, I hope Lucy doesn't go for it.
No. It would be such a step back for Lucy to indulge in blood and violence like that. So the power would come from her being able to say no, even if Marisica makes it a deal she can't refuse. But I think part of the reason I vibe with this, with the idea of this prediction, wanted to bring it up, even if I don't necessarily think it'll be true, is like obviously we've talked a lot about how the three culprits map to the three Kenneteers, but we've also just been talking about how Pale doesn't let things just be one thing. And we've seen like Verona is obviously talking to Charles at the moment, and that there's been some overlap there and stuff. And I think it would be interesting to explore the stuff between Lucy and Marisica, because Marisica has just juiced herself up on blood and violence. And, you know, from what we've seen of her, is kind of still dealing with that. And I think that that's super interesting to play into, like, Lucy as somebody who is trying to learn to balance and potentially shed that side of herself too. So I actually think Marisica and Lucy could have some interesting stuff to talk about. And then we're getting both angles too of the, like, Lucy Verona friendship being explored, because then you've got the Lucy culprit talking to the Verona and the Verona culprit talking to the Lucy. Like it just it feels like that perfectly Pale thing of like there's multiple layers happening at once sort of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like the idea of the culprits kind of cross connecting when Lucy and Verona are unable to connect with each other.
Yeah, or just as they're starting, it feels like they're starting to find ground, yes, or they're heading in the right direction. So what better way to really start to fuck with that then, you know, get Charles and Verona and Marisica and Lucy as, you know, people who are talking to each other.
I like it. I like the concept of it. I'm sure I won't like the consequences of it if it happens.
Yeah, 100%.
So yeah, we also have a discussion question that we've been running for the past fortnight. So time to collect some discussion question answers and talk about them. These discussion question answers were on the question of how should parents balance giving responsibility to kids the Kenneteers' age?
Yeah, which is a big question, and we got some big answers. So
yes, we did. Which
apologies. Yeah, pretty apologies for how much we're going to like condense some of the points you all made, because they're great. That's a good point. You know, we'll be here for 2 hours if we sort of read them all out in full.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good answers here, so do go and read them, but we'll talk about them at a kind of higher level, I suppose.
Yeah, I'd be willing to say that like the median level of quality to the answers we got here is the highest of any discussion question we've ever got. Like, I think these were some of the best quality answers we've ever gotten.
Yeah, yeah. Let's start with Scruza. I really liked Scruza's response. Scruza was talking about, I suppose, analyzing kind of what they would trust kids with in the real world, and from there kind of extrapolating what the borders of responsibility for a practitioner parent should be, which I thought was really interesting. Like thinking about, like, you know, how much I want a kid to be tied down in long-term situations, which means probably familiar and domain rituals are off the table, or at least kind of we'd do some like make sure they have some experiences of trying out long-term relationships and being kind of in a situation where they're talking to their potential familiars for a number of years before they're making these decisions. Whereas implements maybe would be a bit better because it doesn't seem as rough, and kind of a lot of things like that, that were kind of really, it felt like really practical advice for practitioner parents, I would say.
Yeah, Scruza was essentially trying to blur out the metaphor and just say, okay, take any magical practice-y situation and just try to map it to the real world equivalent. And that should give you a pretty solid benchmark of, should I allow my magical kid to do X?
Mm.
I liked it as a system. I think most of the comparisons they made a lot of sense. Like, you know, would I send my kid unaccompanied to a realm? Well, would I send them to an amusement park, like, or a sketchy neighborhood? Like, you know, like comparisons like that, I think made a lot of sense.
Mm. Yeah.
I also really liked one of their opening points was they mentioned, like, we talked about how obviously like the Kenneteers are sort of better than Easton in part because of the struggle and the responsibilities they've had.
Yes. But
Scruza did want to point out that that doesn't necessarily mean that like more responsibility maps one-to-one with people being better. And they specifically pointed to, if you gave Easton more responsibility, it would be a disaster. Which is like a really good point. Although, like, you know, kind of coming from the space of Easton's already a bad egg, and that's why giving it to him now would be a disaster. Like it's only a part of the picture. And, you know, you also have to deal with the fact that, you know, sometimes you're not starting from zero with kids like Easton.
Mm.
I really like that. You know, a recurring theme in both Pale and these answers is going to be like one size doesn't always fit all.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. Speaking of one size not fitting all, that was the core of Megafire 7's response, kind of thinking about basically you need to speak with your specific child, because the generalized advice is probably not going to work, which is probably very true, but doesn't give us a lot to discuss.
Yeah. It was a very, like, this was almost a cheeky answer, because it's right. Like, Megafire is obviously right that trying to lay down blanket rules is a bad practice and you shouldn't do it. But then also that did allow them to just write kind of one paragraph that was like, just figure it out individually and talk to the kid. Which is like, well, yes.
Yeah,
like,
very true. Very true.
But that seems like you're intentionally evading the question. Megafire did specifically touch on, like, you know, and this has been true in a lot of the stuff that they've written that we've talked about on here as well. They place a lot of emphasis on giving kids like their own space, like, and Megafire's talked about this very specifically in terms of Verona and a lot of their essays on the subreddit, like,
yeah,
Verona not having control of her room is a big thing. And I find it interesting because I think I'm less attached to that as an idea. Like, I guess as somebody who like went to a boarding school where you shared rooms up until you were 17, I have a very different relationship with the idea of having your own space, especially like mostly as a kid. But I definitely think that like that is touching on the idea of like kids need some way of self expression. And whether that is, you know, for someone like Verona, I think Megafire is absolutely spot on that it comes in the form of like needing your own space. Mm. But for other kids, it can be other things.
Yeah. It's a good call. Which other ones did I really like? Oh, I liked Propaganda Pagoda's response, yes. Which was about kind of, this was very much not practitioner related advice at all, but just kind of talking about this situation in abstract for real world parents, although you could apply it to practitioner stuff around like the responsible allocation of chores as a way to start building responsibility for children. And then that kind of made me think about like, what are the practitioner equivalent versions of chores that can give your kids some level of responsibility to grow into healthy adults? Like, you know, Propaganda Pagoda is talking about a bit like making sure that your child has a variety of different chores. They can become kind of a fully skilled adult and not like, you know, an adult who doesn't know how to do laundry or something. Right. Like,
yeah. Well, and cause I was one of those. I went to college. I didn't know how to wash my clothes. I didn't know how to like wash dishes barely. Like I was a useless sack of crap. When I moved out, and it was a very rough first couple of months.
What's the practitioner version of that, right? And I was thinking about like helping with wardings or diagrams, maybe as like, or like, you know, maintaining relationships with others as like ways to kind of build these skills that will turn you into a better, fully rounded practitioner, I guess, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because here you kind of run into the thing where the practice usually is more the job, right? Like that would getting a kid to help out with the wardings and the diagrams is almost more akin to bringing them into the office and getting them to type up a spreadsheet or two. I guess that's the thing about practice is it kind of takes over and becomes both. So it becomes a really interesting line to walk where the line between chore and helping out with work can become very blurry.
For sure.
I think it would be hard in a lot of practitioner families to identify something that is just a chore that is magically relevant.
Mm.
That said, I'd be willing to bet that a lot of these kids who go to the BHI probably don't do a lot of chores in general.
Mm. Yeah, probably true.
Like just maybe we don't need to bring the magic into it. Maybe more of them just need to wash their clothes and cook their own meals.
Yeah. Sengachi had a good one that I quite liked, which was reframing the conversation in terms of this conversation with like Lucy and Jasmine really was the key, I think, around threat management rather than responsibility. And the example was like Lucy isn't, in air quotes, responsible for police reform, but does need to have realistic expectations about existing in a world with like institutionalized police violence, right? Like in the same way, Sengachi was saying that they shouldn't think of it as the Kenneteers being responsible for and like taking on a responsibility that they don't need to, but more learning how to deal with a world that is dangerous and what the right actions should be within that, which I think was a very interesting, a very interesting response. Although I don't necessarily fully agree in the sense that like, I don't think this is something that is like immediately manageable or even something that they're necessarily going to face, like, you know, racist policing, let's say, as the example. It feels more like an abstract or long-term degradation, like, you know, global warming would be my example of like something that I fully expect they could play within the system and completely avoid the negative repercussions of this practitioner society, but obviously that's kind of setting up fucked things for future generations. And then maybe that's maybe that's also possible to like play within the system to avoid police racism, but kind of constraining yourself to behave in a way that is not who you are. And so maybe I'm kind of making breaking the relationship where they actually are more similar than I think they are. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, because this is very much the answer that probably touches the most on what I was trying to grapple with when I like threw out this as a candidate question, which was if you're someone like Jasmine specifically, hey, yeah, how do you balance preparing your kid for the world with not making them hate everything and like taking their childhood from them? Like how do you allow someone like Lucy not to turn into a 14-year-old who specializes in murdering bad dads, but also realistically prepare her for the struggle she's going to have to deal with? And I really like the way Sengachi frames it as like to a certain degree they have to be aware of it, and it comes down to like framing it, balancing responsibility versus like awareness, and like I guess casually not empowering the system. Like, you know, there's a difference between saying, or between say like being Greta Thunberg and like actively fighting global warming and being somebody who just recycles and like, you know, doesn't like drive diesel. And yeah, so like how do you balance, you know, not necessarily needing your kid to be an eco warrior, but also making sure that, you know, they're not making things worse.
It's, I don't know. It's these are tough things. I'm glad I'm not a parent. We also had a response from Lurking Beluga, which I liked, which was more talking about the power dynamics in their relationship and the fact that the Kenneteers, from a like, you know, power perspective, do are actually kind of more powerful, and this is a flipped dynamic compared to something like Lurking Beluga, compared it to studies where children are primary breadwinners, something like child actors, for example, right? Like, and how that fundamentally changes what the relationship between a parent and a child is, which I thought was very interesting. And
I really liked this angle. Like, this was one of the funnest answers to read, because Lurking Beluga really took an interesting and in-depth direction with it. Like, this is one of the ones I'd suggest everyone go actually read.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, the thing that jumped out to me about it was it felt like this situation becomes a major problem in bad parent-child relationships, right? Like, and I think VD and Verona is a good example of that, where like VD is trying to, seems to have this idea of like, I'm the parent, therefore you have to do what I say. And Verona clearly is not in that state anymore, if she ever was, of like, she now has, in air quotes, enough power that she doesn't have to listen to VD when he's making bad demands. But in comparison, like Jasmine and Lucy's relationship, like, is not about power. It's about respect and love. And it was interesting. Like, this really obviously kind of becomes a major problem if your relationship as a parent is defined by having power over your child, I guess.
Yeah. And because I think the reason I love this comparison to things like child actors and stuff is because this is really what, like, the reason the relationship between the Kenneteers and their parents has changed is because, like, they, in the gap between them learning about this world and telling their parents, they've gone up a few levels to the point where the classical parent child power dynamics just don't make sense anymore. And that like the link to child actors there is such a great one, because it's like they, like, Lucy has to be able to make decisions and overrule her mum on stuff because she knows more and she's more equipped to deal with stuff. But Jasmine is still very much reeling from accepting the fact that even though she's still 14, there's now more to her and Lucy's relationship than just parent child. And I think that's like, you know, that's obviously something like any coming of age relationship like goes through this. Like, I do remember when I was like 19 or 20, I'd been at college for like 2 years, and I came back to stay with my parents one like winter break or something. And I went out drinking with friends and came back at like 2 a.m. and my mom was sitting in the living room awake watching TV because she wanted to stay awake till I got home in case I needed like a lift or anything. And it was very much like, Mom, I've been out drinking with friends for, you know, 2 years now. Like, this is completely unnecessary. And it was one of those moments where, like, you know, we sort of had to have a chat about how, you know, I was a grown adult now. I didn't need that. And I think Jasmine is just being caught off guard by how early that's happening with her and Lucy.
I loved a lot of these discussion question answers. They were all, every single one of them took a different angle, and it was really fun to read them all.
Yeah.
Like, really strong stuff.
I loved reading all of these answers.
New discussion question time, Elliot.
Yeah. I'm so sad that you deleted your original pitch for a discussion question.
My original pitch was, which bad dad does Lucy need to fight next?
I mean, the only problem with it is the answer. The only answer is Brett.
Yeah, it's already seen VD. Yeah,
we're already seeing that in the chat. Yeah. Literally, the only problem with that question is that there's only one answer. I think what we've decided to go for instead is, which of the three Kennets would you choose to live in, and which is the one you'd spend the least time in?
As a reminder, we don't just want everyone to say Kenneth found. We want some very varied answers here.
I think, you know, get into the why, because I think what's interesting is, like, we saw Verona kind of rank them. I feel like the origin of this in my head was when Verona did her ritual. She kind of ordered them, where she said, Kennet found and Kennet below. I can't remember which one was the top, actually, but, you know, she kind of put Kennet above as the bottom. So I almost want to see everyone give a ranking to all three, because then even if we get a bunch of Kennet founds at top, I'll be interested to see where the other two fit for people.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
So yeah, it's basically, I guess the real discussion question is rank the three Kennets in how much time you'd spend in them and why.
And why, yeah.
The end why will be crucial to actually getting your answer read out, basically.
Yes.
I mean, what's your answer to this, Ruben?
Well, Kennet found is at the top. Now, I don't know.
So the answer you said people shouldn't give.
Yeah, Kennet found's at the top, and I'm not going to explain why. No, I don't know. I'm kind of like... It's interesting. I think they all have very different strengths and weaknesses. Is it boring to say I wouldn't want to live in Kennet Below or Kennet Found? I would want to live in normal Kennet, and I would just want to visit the other two.
No.
You know, like, they're not. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? I think you have just stuck on the key thing here, which is that you have to live there. And I think living in Kennet Found might come with more downsides than you might initially think of. For people, but yeah, I don't think saying Kennet above is actually as boring an answer. Like, I think the story has been making its case for why that third arm is necessary. Like, in Charles's world, there are problems. Like, I think the above side, like, if you sort of map it to the three Kenneteers and the old trio Jay used to talk about, of it was like sense, story, and something else, like, Kennet above is important, and like, Lucy is, I think, the one who's going to continue to live in Kennet above. So you're making the same choice as Lucy, really.
Yeah, yeah, and she's my favorite, so I think that makes sense.
Yeah, whereas, like, I'm going to put it out there, I think I'd go for Kennet below.
That's wild. That's a wild thing to say.
I might have to write up my own.
And I know Verona is your favorite, but even so. That's so hardcore.
See, this has nothing to do with Verona. In fact, I almost hesitated to say it because it sounded like the I'm copying Verona answer. But
yeah,
no,
you're
I have
just
legitimate
copying Verona.
I have legitimate reason. I do worry about the violence. That is a concern. But I have ways I think I could mitigate it.
I do think in Discord, so Ian Frank is saying he just really liked Brilk, which I think is very funny.
I just want to live with Mal. I'll just, you know, help out her mom with her business.
But so what's the appeal? Like, putting aside the violence, which is the first thing that springs to mind for me in Kennet Below, what's the appeal?
Freedom feels like the wrong word, but there's the lack of bullshit, I think, is honestly what it is.
Definitely not Kennet Found for you then.
Yeah, I think Kennet Found, there's definitely the peacefulness of Kennet Found is very, very appealing, obviously. But I think I would struggle with, I like to have my little space. Like that, you know, that's just like, you know, I'm not like a libertarian or any of that dumb bullshit. I understand the importance of community, but like, the, you know, at the end of the day, there's the, you know, there needs to be sort of my room, and that's, you know, where my stuff happens or whatever. And I need a private stuff. And I think conceptually Kennet Below feels like the place where you're going to get that the easiest.
I'll
write it.
Fair enough. I look forward to seeing it. But yeah, if you want to leave your discussion question answers, you can post them in our discussion thread, which will be linked in the show notes down below.
Yes, you can also find us on Twitter. We are, now, according to Ruben's lie, we've been always posting memes, and we're continuing
every
to
day.
Do so.
We've been posting daily memes, not always, just for the past, like, what, 4 months or so?
yeah, certainly more than just the most two recent days.
Yep. But yeah, so check out our Twitter at PerilFlectCast. There's some top tier memes on there. You can also head to our website, doofmedia.com, to get more information on the network and all of the other shows on the Doof Media Network. There are a lot of them, and they're all awesome. So go check them out.
Yeah, and if you want those shows to keep happening, they honestly wouldn't without our Patreon. That's basically the only reason we're able to like dedicate the time and get the resources to do them. So patreon.com/doofmedia if you want to you know, keep all the various shows going.
Yeah, not just do you keep the shows going, but you also get to get like perks, like bonus content. If you pay attention to our feed, you may have heard a teaser for a bonus thing that we did recently with Jenny and Milia from other shows on the network. And you can get the full access to that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/doofmedia to get full access to that 5-star episode.
I mean, you know, 5-star jokes aside, and, you know, we can put them aside because I'm going to be making them for months probably.
Yeah. It was a very fun episode.
We
spent a lot of time talking about weird food, which was very on-brand. I really loved it.
It was probably about 2/3 talking about pate and 1/3 talking about weird shit.
Just culinary weirdness from our lives, which really was delightful. Genuinely, it was such a fun show. If you want more culinary weirdness, the best way to get it is by supporting Wild Bo's Patreon for things like pate and brilk and all the other culinary disasters that Wild Bo has introduced to our lives. If you want more of those, the best way to get them is to continue to support Wild Bo. So go to patreon.com/WildBo and ensure that we'll have a steady stream of weird food and drink for years to come.
Yeah, but you know, like, just putting it out there, we are trying to steal a lot of them for All Packed Up too. So some nicer ones, just, just maybe some really I suppose they have gone to like really delicious fast food places, but we can't.
Yeah, and there's like, what's that place that Sheridan loves in Thunder Bay that sounds like it's like.
Yeah, it's like just like. It's called like Full On or like. Yeah.
Yeah. That just sounds like, you know, that kind of food where I feel like very American style food where it's just like, here's a big thing that has all the nice flavors and you'll only really want to eat the first third of it, but you're going to eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's that classic vibe.
It's my favorite brand of food.
It is a fun vibe of food every once in a while. But anyway, yes.
Bonky Donks. See, more stuff like Bonky Donks.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in and see you next time.